So Medicare levy surcharge has been considered a threat. Global financial crisis has got everybody concerned, and in particular the prospects of unemployment making inroads into health insurance. So we've got a direct passage through those factors. But certainly the growth rate is slower now than it has been in the last couple of years. But there's a fair part of the growth rate of financial 08, I think, can be attributed to the change in the legislation and the advent of broader health cover and the general promotion and increase in support that came out of that process, both from the government and from the organisations themselves, in focusing a lot on advertising. unemployment is interesting. Paul Collins at FEAC included this in a presentation that went up on FEAC's website at the end of March, and I was very taken with this. The purple line that you see there is comparable to the membership graph I just showed you a moment ago, but now we've got a participation rate in terms of persons, the number of persons, proportion of persons who are covered by health, hospital insurance on the right-hand axis. The x-axis is for a more narrow span than the previous one, and of course the population change over the course of time makes it look like we're well down over here compared to up on the left-hand side, whereas on the other graph the two were pretty comparable. So the thing I take out of this is that unemployment's gone up and down, but you can't read a lot into unemployment driving changes in health insurance participation. If you were suspected back in the early 80s, the movements in there might be related, then I draw your attention to the fact that the government of the day put in a rebate for private health insurance, basic private health insurance, that had a very pronounced effect in raising health insurance participation rates, and a subsequent government took that away, and you can see the effects there. So the outtake that I have from this is that health insurance participation is primarily a function of government decisions about the conduct of private health insurance. The other factor that I have in the back of my mind, having thought about this for on and off for some weeks now, is that unemployment, of course, is a movable feast, and there are people moving in and out of the employment statistics. There's a shift between full-time and part-time, between males and females, and a whole range of underemployment or overtime hour issues associated with all of this. So I'm not saying that we should completely ignore unemployment, but I'm not quite as worried by this as a leading indicator as might have been before I saw that. Some of the comments that have been made recently in the press attributed to these organisations appear here. Apologies. Bupa has suggested 10% of existing policyholders, mostly younger members, did not renew their policies. Well, that sounds to me that at first glance that 10% of their membership has just dropped off the end of the tree. I'm sure that that hasn't happened. But certainly the forecasts that have been published here of 4% net growth falling to 1%, and when Medibank Private talks 6% net growth reducing to zero, and when NIB says that their numbers are down as well, the general trend and the general expectation, including in my own organisation, is that growth will certainly not be as great in the coming 12 months as it might have been in the last 12 to 24 months. I've got to be very conscious, though, when I read things like this, that statements made by health insurance chief executives can get interpreted in various ways by journalists. So I think it's more an indication than anything else. Pressure that comes to health insurance in terms of pricing or in terms of costs and therefore finds its way through to pricing, in part is driven by the age distribution. When you look at this portrayal, you can see that in recent years the industry has done things to, and it makes it sound like the industry is acting, maybe the government has done some of these things as well, but the industry has boosted its share or its participation in the 25 to 39 age cohort and in the 60 plus. Of course, the major reason for the 60 plus is that many of the baby boomers are going across that age threshold. And I could say something about myself, but I'm not quite there yet. But fortunately, these people in the over 60 category are not diluting that cohort of people in terms of the claims rates, because they are, of course, just over 60. People who are age 60 now are those who are born in 1949, and there's still an awful lot of baby boomers to come across the horizon. My recollection is that the peak of the baby boomers were about 1961. In terms of their worth. Price increases have moderated in recent years. We saw a little bit of an increase in 2009 compared to previous years, and I think many commentators would say that the long-term cost pressures on at least the hospital part of private health insurance might be running at something like 6 or 7%. I think the moderation that we saw in price increases in 2000-2001 is a consequence of the great inflow of new members at that time. Many of them had younger cohorts. What we see over here in the last 3 or 4 years is just a smaller scale version of what we saw back in 2000 and 2001, a lot more moderate. And of course, the other portrayal here in terms of just looking at the risk profile and various ways that this can be done. My organisation uses risk weights that came out of Trowbridge's risk equalisation studies in 1999, based on the experience of 97. I've compared notes with Andrew. He does this completely differently, using information that comes out of more recent FEAC publications. But the outcome that you get in terms of the shape of the graph is the same regardless of what the parameters you use here. A pronounced downturn in costs in 2000, a return to normalcy from there on, and some abatement back in the recent years over here. Now remember, this is not the risk profile, this is the risk profile change from year to year.
The rate increases that you showed early in 2000.
Yes.
What about the
Yes.
In 2000 and 2001. It's basically because the risk equalisation created in parts was more than support the
industry. Yes. But the risk equalisation for the industry nets out at zero.
That's right. But you have a lot more contributing to that.
Yes, there's certainly a lot more contributing to that. I think the industry increased by about 40 or 45% around that time, and the claims load of the industry didn't increase by.
That
helped us. Yes. So I might move on and pass to Ben, who's going to carry the baton from us.
Thanks, David. So we'll probably just go through a bit of a snapshot of the industry from financial metrics, if you like. At 30 June, there were 38 players, although at October, there was one less. Druids got merged, effectively. The revenue went up, obviously, 12.2 billion. Gross margin went down slightly. The MER did increase slightly from the previous year, and that was driven by M&A expenses and as well as product approvals and registration process with Department of Health. So the net margin reduced slightly from the previous year. The interesting note is that the investment performance, as you can see, as the difference between the net margin and profit before tax, the difference is very small. And in the annual report for 5, there was a note of a loss from investments of $11 million. So the increase from margin to profit is actually from other income. The capital adequacy of the industry is still pretty good, 2.73 times the amount of the coverage. That's the number of times the net assets covers the capital adequacy requirement. So the reserve, we don't have a comparison with previous years, but in terms of solvency, the equivalent multiple for solvency, this has actually reduced from 3.31 to 3.16. And you can, you know, draw your conclusions on what led to the reduction. The following graph just shows a bit more of a time series of the previous snapshot. So it goes back to 1990. The red line is your gross margin, and the black line is your net margin. So the difference is your expenses. So I can see that the gap has been fairly constant over time. Interestingly, the yellow line, that's your profit as a percentage of your contributions, that has varied relative to the black line. So in the last 6 years, the gap has, you know, slowly crept up, except for 08, where the yellow line basically went back to the black line, so investment income was significantly reduced. Next slide just shows a bit more on management expenses. As I said before, the MER was about 10.5%. And this just shows that there's a lot of variability depending on size of the insurer. There is a bit of a bunch of outliers on the top left of the graph, and they're high. They have a higher MER for various reasons. As well as there is, you know, the outline in the bottom left, and again they've got, you know, very special circumstances for that particular fund. And I'd like to point out that Andrew's really proud of this graph because it's got a long scale on the axis at the bottom, which is pretty great. So the next slide I want to touch on is just to give you a bit of a snapshot of risk equalization for the last 5 calendar years. So the main thing to get out from this slide is the dollar tax per SEU that each SEU has to pay. And currently, for the last calendar year, CYOA is $449. And the increase of that tax has been quite variable. It is important to note that in calendar year 07, the new risk equalization scheme did start in the June quarter. So there is a bit of a blip at 12.5%. Question is, I guess, you know, whether the new arrangement actually led to an increase, or that was driven by other pressures such as aging or just general utilization. So that's a bit of a graph to show the before and after the switch from the old reinsurance to the new risk equalization arrangement. So I'll leave you to ponder on whether there was a bit of an impact. At the last convention, we mentioned that the Health Insurance Act was being proposed, and it now actually has been passed, and we have been using it for the last 2 years. So just to give you a very quick summary of what has happened, the legislation was restructured and now has 23 accompanying rules. Ancillary has been renamed as general treatment. We now have SISs, broader health cover, and reinsurance, as I said before, has been renamed or replaced by risk equalization. And probably useful to note that the risk equalization pool now includes high cost claims, whereas previously it was a 35-day chronic disease. Quick recap on M&A activity for the last year or so, and this is mainly already covered by Andrew and Ian's presentations earlier this week. So I won't really sort of go back to cover that too much. Health insurance has a lot of cost pressures, as you're aware. Your premiums go up every year by, you know, whatever, 5-6% based on the last 5 years. We have health pressures as well as health insurance pressures. I won't go through all of it. But the key ones is, you know, utilization, that's aging, just general technological advances, and things like table drift, which is another word for members moving across from tables, if you like, downgrading or not. So that's a bit of a term coined by Andrew. And David. Probably should cover some of the political influences. Health insurance, as you know, is a very political beast. Since the last convention, we have a new government, and policies have been reviewed. The rebate has been continuing, even though Treasury did, you know, bring up recommending to abolish it in 2007. The Medicare legacy surcharge, as we mentioned before, has changed. Impact of that is still, you know, questionable. We don't really know. Wait and see. The main thing, I guess, that probably all actuaries should be aware of is that lifetime health cover, the first lot of members who have been with PHI for 10 years will have the loading removed. So we've called these people graduates, if you like, so they've, you know, moved on to the next phase of their PHI life. And they can now enjoy lifetime health cover loading 3 years of their PHI life. And there's been quite a few other reports that have been released in the meantime, which I'll hand over to Andrew to cover in more detail.
Now remember, we do want to try and make this interactive, so if you've got a burning question on a slide, stick your hand up, you might have forgotten about it by the time we get to the end. So I'll try and get through some of these slides, and if there's some questions, please interrupt me. The Medicare levy surcharge changes, a lot of you will be familiar with this, that late last year there were some changes to the income limits that were set and not indexed for 11 years, the $50,000 for singles and $100,000 for families, that if you've got income above that level and you don't have private health insurance, you have to pay an extra 1%. Medicare levy surcharge. So they were increased to $70,000 and $140,000, effective from the current tax year. And I suppose David has talked about the potential negative impact of this on some recent membership growth trends, but it's yet to be seen. If there is significant change in membership trends and the growth flattens or we get membership declines, of course there would be flow-on effects to risk equalisation, because really the high-cost members are not going to drop out, leaving a lower pool of members to spread the costs, and really to think about potential impacts. If the future isn't going to be as rosy as the past, then there might be a need to increase risk margins that are adopted in things like the liability adequacy test that Peter talked about that in his paper. A significant thing that's going on at the moment, the Commonwealth Government has set up the National Health and Hospitals Reform Commission to look at health financing and delivery arrangements in Australia. They've issued a very large interim report. There's a picture of the front page, but there's hundreds and hundreds of pages. I recommend you at least have a look at it and a scan through it if you're interested. There is a final report not too far away in the future, about the middle of the year. One of the major things, we just picked out a couple of the major things that might impact on private health insurance. The governance arrangements for particularly the Medicare system, there are three options put forward. One is effectively continue on the way we go with some minor changes. Another one is to suggest that the Commonwealth take over responsibility for delivery of that through regional health authorities that would be set up at, you know, maybe capital cities would have two or three or four of these regional health authorities to marshal health resources in that area. And option C, which would have the biggest impact on private health insurance, I think, would be that, once again, the Commonwealth's solely responsible for all aspects of healthcare, but utilising a system of compulsory insurance with consumer choice that the existing private health insurers would be able to participate in. Perhaps other organisations may be set up to do that, where to try and introduce some competition. If you know anything about the Netherlands system, I think this is probably the Netherlands option. So a bit more about this. The Commonwealth would actually finance this, and a risk-adjusted premium would be paid by the Commonwealth to your chosen insurer, everyone would sign up with an insurer. So there would be risk-adjusted premiums depending on your health status or aspects describing, I suppose, your expected costs. And the idea is to get some competition going to try and drive more cost-effective outcomes. Because the price to the there's no direct price to the customer in this model, or if there was a price, it would still be community rated. I suppose you've got to think about what would be the role for what we think of today as private health insurance in this model. It might be as top-up cover, so it would be perhaps truly supplementary, although we've never really been able to decide in Australia whether private health insurance is complementary or supplementary. This would pretty much make this explicit. Another suggestion in the report is something to try and address the gap, I suppose, in dental coverage for a large percentage of the population. We have private health insurance, of course, funding dental services. We have a public dental service as well, but the idea here is to similarly introduce a universal dental scheme to bring all of the population into dental coverage, and it would be financed through, I suppose, an additional Medicare levy of 0.75% of taxable income. And once again, you've got to think about how this would impact private health insurance, bringing some of what is today in the ancillary products into the DentiCare scheme, and private health insurers may be able to provide top-up cover. So it says here the cover would be at a basic level and not cover the more major dental type features. Once again, funded by a risk-adjusted government premium.
It's interesting. That's the one thing in the report that I've looked at in really detail. And the 0.75% increase in Medicare is on the assumption that there will be absolutely no change in demand and no change in prices.
Yes. There certainly would have to be a whole lot of pent-up demand. I mean, there's a long waiting list for public dental treatment. That lead on to more significant health problems. So I think if you're thinking about this area, there's probably two problems to solve. One is the long-term system, and the other one is the short-term issue of how to deal with that backlog of the need for significant dental work on, what is, let's say, a generation of lack of funding in this area.
The other interesting thing is, why the 85%? And who's going to pay for the fee? Yeah. Is it going to be the funds? Who's going to pay for that?
So it's initially designed to be a co-payment, I suppose, by the insured, by the person seeking treatment, but whether there's... Certainly the ADA are not a supporter of this proposal at this stage.
You're being modest.
I am. In private health insurance, there's just a myriad of stakeholders that are involved in the private health insurance sector in one way or another. Governments, regulators, providers, insurers, people like ourselves, the Institute of Actuaries, rating agencies, and customers and policyholders. In terms of FEAC and its activities, we actually have a new CEO at FEAC, Sean Gass, down the front here. Perhaps you might make some comments later on if I miss some things that FEAC's currently working on. But things on the slide there, they have a program of fund visits, which they're finishing the first round of that. A lot more attention has been given to risk management and corporate governance in the last year or two. There's a current review of the solvency and capital adequacy arrangements. Risk equalisation, we've had 2 years on the new system. I suppose there's the potential to increase some of the $6 limits or parameters, but there hasn't been any discussion about any forthcoming changes at this stage. The regulatory returns, the statistical returns that go into FEAC have had some modifications recently, and also a monthly report has been instituted in the last couple of months to collect some membership and claims information. The Solvency and Capital Adequacy Standards Review that is currently in progress, there's been a number of discussion papers issued over the course of the last 18 months or so. The current position is that the proposed changes to the standards are expected to be announced in a couple of months' time, hopefully for implementation early next year. It's expected that the sorts of things that may receive a lot more attention is the asset side of the balance sheet, credit risks, investment risks, in response to, I suppose, worldwide issues and response of other regulators as well. The FEAC also issued some governance standards, perhaps not impacting directly on actuaries and actuarial issues, but key changes around the importance of board composition and independence for directors, board charters, performance reviews, the role of board audit committees, and ensuring that there's access to senior management by FIAC. Now, Peter's paper the other day, if you were at that session, comprehensively dealt with the issues around AASB 1023 and the liability adequacy test, and discussion about whether the test's done at aggregate or hospital and general treatment level. So I probably won't spend any more time talking about the liability adequacy test. The Health Practice Committee of the Institute of Actuaries has been working on a couple of fronts in the last year or so. We've been reviewing our guidance notes, and there was a session earlier in the week about that, updating those three guidance notes we have in the areas of liabilities, projections and financial condition reports. We've also been updating the private health insurance online CBD course that hopefully some of you have done, and if not, you can sign up to do an online course to learn more about private health insurance and particularly the actuarial involvement. And a health financing course was held just a couple of months ago that had a wide attendance from outside of the profession, run by the profession, but in conjunction with Richard Madden, University of New South Wales, Sydney. Yeah. And also Ben has continuing to oversee the production of the private health insurance newsletter on a regular basis. So if you're not on the distribution list for that, please let us know and we'll get you on the distribution list, and you'll get an email every few weeks or so updating you on what's going on in private health insurance. So, where are those burning questions or comments or statements? We've probably got another 10 minutes or so to discuss any of the issues we have presented or something else that you'd like to talk about. Maybe there's some people who'd like to comment about, you know, what are we've had a risk management focus in this convention. What sort of risks are facing private health insurers in the next year or two? It might be a thought starter. You want to make any remarks, Sean?
Perhaps take up your invitation.
I might just kind of. Good morning, everyone. I'm Sean Gath. I'm the new CEO of the Private Health Insurance Administration Council. This is where I scored a moment on the PowerPoint display, so I definitely exist. I'm pleased to hear about that. I've been doing this job for about 10 months now, taking over from a very remarkable predecessor in the form of Gail Ganane, who I'm sure many of you knew, a powerful and significant formative presence in the whole industry for a number of years. So they're big shoes to fill, even though they're quite small shoes at one level. In the last 10 months, I've covered quite a lot of territory and visited most of the funds, and I think got a reasonably good sense of what's going on in the industry now. One thing I do know is that at FEAC we love actuaries. We think they're wonderful people, and we can't get enough of them. We're strong
advocates for the role, particularly of appointed actuaries in the overseeing the affairs of funds. We want the funds to have very good and constructive relationships with their actuarial consultants. And we have recently reinforced in a letter from the Commissioner to the chairs of the funds, intended to be at the highest level, a strong restatement of our desire for the funds to rigorously adhere to the requirements that apply in the private health insurance sector in relation to communication between appointed actuaries and the funds, and to ensure that the statutory standards in relation to notifiable events are properly observed. So we see the role of actuaries in the operation of funds as being absolutely central to the proper prudential management of the industry. I probably could go through a number of the points that Andrew has, but won't. I think the main messages from FEAC at the moment are that we are obviously closely observing what's going on in the global financial crisis. Andrew referred to our monthly reporting. He didn't mention, and perhaps I ought, that that new monthly report is a temporary measure. It was expressly announced as a temporary measure. And really, we're just keeping an eye on things. There was quite a lot of attention paid in the early part of the presentation when David spoke to movements in membership rates. It's obviously a key indicator of general health in the industry, and an early warning sign perhaps of potential areas for concern. So the council has instituted a monthly report, so we're now receiving monthly data on movements in memberships. Fortunately, the picture so far has been an upward trend, and without disclosing in detail what's lies ahead for the March quarter statistics, nothing dramatic has changed, if I could put it as neutrally as that. So at that level, we're reasonably comfortable. The industry is on solid tracking ground. The prudential position of the industry is also good at the moment. I gave evidence to the Senate Estimates Committee a month or two ago, and where I gave a revised update on the capital adequacy and solvency ratios for the industry, so I can slightly update the information that Ben gave you, but it's on the public record as well if you ever suffer from insomnia and need to read Hansard. But the capital adequacy ratio is 2.1 and the solvency ratio is 2.5 for the industry as of the end of the December quarter. So it's come down a little bit again since those stats were produced as part of our annual report. So overall, we're reasonably content with how the industry is tracking at the moment. From a prudential perspective, it seems to be on reasonably solid ground. The investment situation has been a concern, and a few funds have taken a couple of heavy hits, which was reflected in the sharp decline in investment income, which we reported in our report on operations last year. But overall, those funds were generally ones, fortuitously I imagine, that were in a position to absorb the losses without significantly impacting on their overall prudential position. So, but nevertheless, I know the council has been actively interested in the whole question of the way in which funds are operating their investments, particularly wanting to ensure that there was a sufficient level of management sophistication, or if not, then certainly access to good advice. So the people had a very good and clear understanding of just what the nature of particular investments were and the risks that attach to different types of investment vehicles. The governance standard's been mentioned as well. That's you said the start-up date, the 1st of July, that's theoretically correct, although we're allowing for a bit of a sunrise period where people will be allowed to bed it down. The real commencement date will be the 1st of January next year, and we're undertaking a consultation process in connection with that. The final message from FEAC is that there's going to be the resumption of a very active training program, which we'll be rolling out and advising the industry about shortly. But that'll cover things like the governance standard, our reporting requirements, dealing with a whole range of additional issues, and we expect to be very active in terms of our training activity in the next 6 to 12 months. That's probably enough for me.
Sean, are you referring to director's education?
I am, amongst other things, yeah. Mm. Yep, the director's education course as well. Okay.
Other comments, questions, observations? Rob, I think, got your hand up first.
Andrew, can you go back to the graph that you had of the data, I think, presented of the risk profile of the industry? You were asked to talk about the risk that the industry is facing. Yes.
That one?
Yes.
Yes.
Now, and of course, this is the rate of change here.
Yes.
As I understand it, what happened to the industry was that the average age of the industry, despite the aging of the Australian population of about 0.2 of a year per year, the average age of the PHI population stayed virtually constant, which largely under the effect of younger policyholders coming in, under the Medicare levy.
Yes, it's probably this graph here.
Yeah,
strong growth on the left-hand side in the 25 to 39 age group.
Yeah.
Which has actually reduced a little bit in the 2008 calendar year, but is still growing reasonably strongly.
Yes. Now, of course, we've had both the economic problems now and also the change in the thresholds, and neither of those probably can be expected to have an immediate impact, and may have an impact over quite some period of time, perhaps 2 or 3 years. So I think it's very important, if you go back to David's graph there, that you can see that there's a bit of an uptick already, and it's quite possible, of course this can be done, they're annual interviews, I guess, are they?
Yes, they are.
It's quite possible that this can be done quarterly, quite possible for it to be done by individual insurers, and I think it's very, very important at the present time that this sort of analysis is done.
Mm. So obviously the risk there is that if all the circumstances, we talk about the young members don't join in the numbers that they have in the past or leave, if this graph heads back to, well, it looks like there's a bit of a trend line of about 2%, that could impose another 1% cost impost.
So earlier on there, my understanding is that the PHI population was ageing at about 0.3 or 0.4 of a year per year. Australian population, as I said, generally averages is about 0.2 of a year per year. So we may get back to a situation over the next, say, 2 or 3 years, where under the influence of increased rebates for older people, with the 35 and 40% rebates, we may get back to a situation where PHI ages quite considerably.
Now, there are at least two other people with their hands up. Do they still want to make their comment? Tori?
My comment, go to the graph where they have had an unemployment rate as opposed to the participation rate. The two things I see with the industry is, I think the jury's out still on NLS. It was still a period where people were thinking of tax returns. They've just received their rate increase letters. So it's going to be a period of that. And I would have thought that in the 90s, the high unemployment really is a direct correlation. There's a high unemployment and there is a continuing downturn in this threshold.
The difficulty with this chart, of course, is that nothing else remains constant. Everything's changing. There's lots of arrows on this chart that says government interaction, government intervention here, here, here. And it is very difficult to do this sort of analysis, of course. And it was a different sort of environment. But
there's a lot of lifetime health coverage. That's made possible much more steady, right? Since this is the first time we've been through a recession with those things in place. So
yeah, so hence the reason Sean has said he's got a monthly return in place to monitor this more frequently than quarterly. And of course, if you're in the industry, you can obviously monitor data as frequently as you like. But yes, the period following rate change, I think, will be important. And obviously, of course, people have a long period to do tax returns through tax agents and the like. So, and they need to become aware of the measure that was really, we're all aware of it, but to get the message out to people, they no longer need health insurance. If you're in that income bracket, it may take some time to get that message through. But the early signs are pretty good. They're still growing. And I think, Peter.
Just to finish up, I think it's great that there's so much focus on the member and the claim side, but I do think that the involvement of activities and the levels of participation involved health insurance We will start asking ourselves the question is how much capital am I going to do that the advisability of the levels of standards department? How much capital is required to meet this level? And what are the investment costs on the line capital supporting the industry? I'm concerned, I see the front page of the Sydney Money Herald's and the International Monetary Fund's assessment of toxic acids has just gone up by 100%. What else is there in the balance sheets? But I think a critical area for that to look at is the amount of capital. And by analogy, when APRA steered some of the bigger government shareholders to using internal models to assess that, what they found was that for long-term costs, we have to require them for about half short-term costs, and the analogy is about doubling them. There's that one that applies from the leader in the major.
It looks like we have run out of time. There's a lot of noise outside, and I think we're at morning tea. So join me in thanking the three presenters, including myself.